Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film.
Let's take a trip back to the Dirty 30s and ride along with the Borrow Gang as we hold up banks, shoot up the police, and fall in love. As we talk Bonnie and Clyde this week on Zach on Film.
Hey, Zach.
Hey, Steven.
Your first time seeing this movie?
Correct.
Rodrigo, first time for you seeing this movie?
In its entirety, yes.
Matthew, first time you've seen this movie?
I have never seen this movie for one very important reason.
Which is?
I hate Warren Beatty with a passion bordering upon the fire of a thousand white hot suns.
Why do you not like Warren Beatty?
Stand Warren Beatty. Well, it really comes down to a film that Warren Beatty made called Town and Country.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Dick Tracy.
Now, I didn't care for that either. I saw Dick Tracy. I saw Heaven Can Wait.
Yeah.
And I always found him to be kind of a slimy central presence.
Right.
But if you've ever seen the movie Town and Country, Town and Country is such a smug Hollywood insider backslapping jackass of a movie. It is just a horrifying, endless stream of really supporting every negative thing that you've ever heard about the Hollywood lifestyle and Warren Beatty as a person. And I had never bumped into Bonnie and Clyde at a point where I could have seen it. And when I could, I actually actively went, you know, Faye Dunaway is pretty and all, but you know, screw Warren Beatty.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of Warren Beatty. I mean, he's done some interesting things, but yeah, I don't know. It's probably the same reason why a lot of people don't like Robert Redford, but I don't know why you wouldn't like Robert Redford. I mean, look at him.
Yeah, man.
I have a similar reaction to what's his
name? Gene Wilder?
Oh, no, I lost. Dane Cook.
Oh.
that's the guy.
I thought you were going to say, like, Dorf.
Yeah.
Dorf. No, I love Tim Conway. I love Richard, but not Richard Pryor. Gene Wilder, the other half of that particular comedy duo. Love Gene Wilder.
Man, we should just
you
do it.
There guys.
There's no Gene Wilder movies on this list. It's too bad because, like, Silver Streak is one of my favorite movies.
Blazing Saddles.
Throw Willy Wonka on here.
Willy Wonka
is culturally significant because I freaking say so.
Uh-huh. Okay.
No. And if the AFI wants to come and sumo wrestle me, I will put on the Rey de Jalisco mask. And I will take them down in my underwear. And none of them will want to get in the ring with me because, frankly, I'm wearing a luchador mask in my underwear and bellowing about Warren Beatty at the top of my lungs. But by God, it will be on the list.
There you go.
Last episode, Willy Wonka. I have spoken.
So, Zach.
Yeah.
What do we think this movie Bonnie and Clyde is about?
This movie is about these two people named Bonnie and Clyde.
Yes.
And
you're supposed to say about 150 minutes.
they kind of like to rob banks and stuff and get a lot of money and get their kicks by driving down Route 66 and robbing banks. And then they don't drive Route 66. So this lovely lady named Bonnie meets this just out of jail guy named Clyde. I think he kind of wants to impress her a little bit. Goes and holds up a convenience kind of old timey convenience store kind of place,
mm-hmm.
And then their fates are sealed and they are running from the law forever and ever until one day they can't run no more.
This is a Rodrigo, a very sexualized movie.
Yeah, it's pretty sexually charged. I mean, like it basically opens on a naked Faye Dunaway. So.
Mm-hmm.
and well done there.
Yeah.
I really, there's a moment where she stands up and there's a Singer sewing machine, and I have never hated a small appliance more in my life.
Well, and then,
I don't want to sound like the old corn dog, but this is a lovely woman wandering around naked.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really great because she walks up to a mirror and you only see her face reflected in the mirror.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then, of course, she steps behind the curtain. You know, she turns around at just the right moment to where you don't see anything, but then she's behind the curtain facing the camera. And then she walks over to the window. And, of course, it's cropped, you know, waist high.
Yeah.
But she walks over to the window and then you cut down to, you cut down to Warren Beatty trying to rob steal a car, and he looks up to this naked woman in a window, and the cross pieces of the window are covering just the right spots, and it's like, so well done. Yeah. From how do you, I mean, on the comic book side, we've seen Amanda, who is it, Amanda Connor? No, who does the, is it Power Girl? Is that Amanda Connor? Or am I thinking Amanda Palmer? Yeah. Okay, so Amanda Connor does the same thing.
Amanda Palmer is Neil Gaiman's wife.
That's right. I always get those two confused. But she does that with several issues of Power Girl, where Power Girl is walking around naked, getting in the shower, and those kinds of things. And just, you know, these things are placed in just strategic places to cover up where things are at. And I like that they did that in here.
Well, yeah, and it was necessary because, I mean, they're already pushing huge boundaries with this movie.
Right.
With sex already, so right. I mean, they're not gonna get anything more than what they already did in this movie. And so then it does take some skill of, I mean, you have to plan out shots with angles and set dressings and everything to pull what you did off and to still make it as sexual as it was.
Well, I mean, even the scene
where she's running down the stairs putting on her dress, and the lighting is perfect because it is literally a shot up her dress. But the lighting is such where you see her clearly lit with her dress starting to close. And as she walks to the down into the darkness, down the stairs, she literally like steps over the camera. But the way it's framed is so gorgeous. She comes down the stairs and is more and more in the darkness before anything inappropriate would show up. It's
there's even the scene where Clyde Barrow is just like, come on, I'm going to go buy you a Coke. And they're standing outside the grocery store and he's basically telling her that he's a criminal. And he's stolen stuff, and she's like, "I don't believe you." And there's this very tight tension between the two of them, where you can tell that there's some attraction between them, and they're glancing back and forth at one another and not looking directly at one another. And he's telling her how great of a robber he is, and equating that to essentially how good of a lover he is. And she's like, "Oh, you're not that good." Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Yeah." And he pulls out this big gun and he's holding it there and kind of dangling it. Very phallically. And then, of course, she reaches out and touches the shaft of the gun, which again is, oh my God, for 1967, for what they're insinuating there is really huge. And then, of course,
coming right on the scenes of the close up of her lips and that Coke bottle.
Yeah.
I mean, this is highly charged erotica by 1967.
It is. And then this is where, you know, the story kind of takes a different turn than what maybe people expect, because I think people always expect the story of Bonnie and Clyde as these tough gangsters that you're just, you know, killing people and robbing banks and doing all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then the moment that she tries to instigate any kind of sexual activity, and even throughout the entire movie, he's just not able to perform. And suddenly he is instantly reduced in stature from what he's been saying this entire time, at least in the eyes of the audience, because he's playing tough and then he can't perform. And she's frustrated by that. He seems to be okay with it. Mm-hmm. And then just like his sexual performance, all of their robberies are kind of the same way. Yes, they're successful in some places, but for the most part, a lot of their early robberies until she really starts to take charge are disasters. Where they're getting nothing because the bank is closed down, or, you know, another one where they're trying to make a getaway and their getaway driver has parked the car somewhere else and can't get around in time. It just kind of their career as robbers seems to follow their relationship as in the sexual sense, because Clyde does say that he does love Bonnie, but he's happy with things the way it is. But Bonnie is constantly frustrated. And I'm going to argue that Bonnie is the instigator in a lot of the actions that the Barrow gang takes. She's the one that says, oh, let's go rob a bank. Oh, let's go do this. Oh, let's do this. I'm frustrated doing this. I'm tired of being here. Let's go do this. And because he's not, I don't know, strong enough or whatever, just kind of does whatever she wants to do. And so from that standpoint, I think that the Bonnie character is a much stronger character, even though she may not get as much face time as Warren Beatty's character. I think that Bonnie is the stronger character throughout. She's able to move the story forward. She's able to cause all the other members of the gang to do what she wants, but she's also very troubled with that. Would you agree with that assessment, Rodrigo, or not?
Yeah, I'd say so. Bonnie is about half the time she is the instigator, and the other half she's the catalyst for Clyde to instigate something, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes she says, let's go do this. And sometimes by basically making Clyde or putting or casting a doubt on Clyde's abilities of any kind is kind of what moves the plot along, at least up until the family gets involved.
Right, right. It's really weird, too, because, again, up until the moment where she sees that he's a failure to perform, it's real funny because they go to that diner. And she's got that little curl in her hair. And even I was watching that. I was like, hey, I really don't like that curl on the side of her hair. Mm-hmm. And I know that was a popular thing. And she's a waitress and they're sitting there and this older waitress comes up and she's got the same style and Clyde doesn't like. And he's like, hey, change your hair. And she instantly does that, whatever he wants. But the minute that he can't perform, that's when she takes over and basically runs the show.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's certain times where she doesn't take control as much where she wants to, and she's kind of put down by Clyde, especially when it comes to Clyde's brother and his wife.
Right,
when she kind of wants to get rid of them, but Clyde won't let them because they're family, and they have to stick with them now because they're in it just as deep as they are. And maybe that is because that she couldn't have as much control as if they were there, that she couldn't exert as much force over the other two as she could as Clyde. But she certainly didn't get her way as much when they were involved in the story. Then I think afterwards, you certainly could say that she drove the couple more.
Yeah. Now, originally, I guess the movie was supposed to be much more sexual than originally written out. Yeah. What were you going to say, Matthew?
More sexual than they could ever do.
Yes.
I think that in a lot of ways, this is a movie about the oral tradition and legends and how they never quite live up to their actual self. Because, I mean, the story of Bonnie and Clyde since, you know, the early 1930s, I heard about Bonnie and Clyde through comics and you know, cartoons, through things when I was a kid. You would hear about Bonnie and Clyde, these, you know, great desperados in the days of the Great Depression, wandering the land, and one if by land and two if by sea. But when you get into this movie is about undermining that photo of Bonnie as the cigar-smoking gun moll and undermining Clyde as this super manly thing, and the two of them as criminal geniuses. And to some degree, the story does that as well. It undermines, you know, Clyde as a character. It undermines their legend. It kind of gives them feet of clay, gives everyone feet of clay, to maybe the detriment of the historical perspective, not mentioning anything at all except for Denver Pyle. But you get to a point where the movie feels very 70s to me.
Right.
In that it takes that malaise. It says, okay, here's this big 30s legend of big talk and big guns and beautiful women. And now we're gonna overlay it with this 70s filter, how everybody's unhappy. Bonnie's running away from boredom. Clyde's running away from maybe having a little bit more interest in DW than he does in Bonnie.
Sure.
And, you know, when it gets to the end of the film, it's kind of that final nail in the metaphorical and literal coffin of the legend. And I have to say I like it, but I'm also a little bit brought down and depressed by the whole
thing. Well, maybe you should be. I mean, it's interesting that you say this feels, you know, like a very 70-ish type film, because that's the other thing that this movie has, which for American audiences was, I don't think they were ready for, and that was the extreme amount of violence.
Mm.
So, you know, if you go back, Zach, into the silent film era days, you know, some guy's running away in the great train robbery and he gets shot in the back and there's like a, you know, 10 minutes of him spinning around and grabbing his chest and flopping around on the floor before he dies. Right. And that's an over exaggeration, but not by much.
Not really.
And then, you know, as we progress through time, anytime someone's getting shot, you know, if somebody gets shot in the chest, they just grab their chest and fall over and they're dead. This is the first time that we see graphic, super graphic depictions of violence in this piece, to the point where we're seeing heads getting blown off. I mean, the final scene where Bonnie and Clyde are ambushed and killed is you know, over the top. I mean, yes, in real life, their car was riddled with bullets and they died. But here you're seeing it from all the different angles, and you're seeing the bodies getting hit and blood spurting everywhere. And I mean, it's not even that one time. I mean, even when Gene Hackman and his wife, what is it, Estelle Parsons, are getting shot by the raid. It's very violent. I mean, even the first time the banker jumps on the side of the car and he gets shot in the face.
Oh, and they don't waste any time getting into the violence in the movie.
No. And
that was shocking. The way that was framed, the way that was put together was like, good Lord.
And so people look at Bonnie and Clyde as this first American movie that opens up the floodgates and say, hey, this kind of violence is okay. So all throughout the 70s, when we're looking at films like Taxi Driver and what are some of the other violent ones that we've Apocalypse Now. These are the movies that came after that. Mm-hmm. So by then it's almost acceptable to have this kind of violence. But this is the first one where people are like, oh, my God, it's the equivalent of going and seeing Reservoir Dogs for the first time.
Yeah.
And you're not accustomed to that kind of violence or Pulp Fiction and not accustomed to seeing that kind of violence. This is a weird movie because it almost, you've got the sex and violence together and they're so intertwined. It sends a really weird message about both of them to audiences, I think. You have some thoughts on that, Matthew?
Yeah, but it's still very Hays Code, you know?
Oh, well, yeah, sure.
It's still like, at the end, crime doesn't pay, everybody dies. And sure. And it is like, it follows that crime drama formula really very closely because you get to live vicariously through these, you know, hard drinking, shooting, dangerous, sexy people. And then at the end, to keep the watchdogs quiet, they kill them. And they're like, see, but you're going to end up dead.
Yeah.
I mean, really, the violence, like the stuff that they depict is very over the top. But in a lot of ways, this is, I mean, obviously, it's based on a true story and the characters did end up dead. But it actually has themes that we've seen in like crime comics and crime novels probably for, you know, 30 years before this.
What I find interesting is that when they're finally able to have sex, that's when the story ends, because the very next thing, we're all happy and we found our place in life and we're going to do the right thing and we're going to do what we need to do. And then bang, they're all dead.
But I mean, that's a trope you see too. Sex equals death. And, you know, nowhere as much as, you know, say The Adventures of Jason Voorhees. But I feel like Rodrigo's point is valid in that this movie is a modern take on the gangster pictures of the 30s, but it still follows a lot of those gangster picture rules to a T.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that's
the point where She's like, oh, you're not such a bad man. And he's like, watch this. Mm-hmm. And he goes and does something ridiculous to impress a girl.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, that's like, you could have seen that in a picture from 1932 with like, what's his name? Jimmy Cagney.
Well, and see, that's kind of the problem.
Gangsters.
Well, that's kind of the problem because Warner Brothers really didn't want to make this movie because they considered this a throwback to their old movie ways. I mean, you know, you talk about Cagney and you talk about the gangster films. That's what they produced. Those are the kind of crime things that they used to produce. And here they'd come so far and to say, yeah, we're going to take a step back and do gangster movies again, seemed to be something against the head studio's wishes, but they went ahead and proceeded anyway. They didn't give it a lot of publicity and ended up becoming the second highest grossing movie for Warner Brothers at that time. But it's interesting that
understandably so.
Yeah, it's interesting that that people will reject going back to the well for things that work. And I mean, I always, as a creative artist, you should be trying to evolve and trying to do something better and something different. But sometimes you have to also do with what works.
That's also a great example of how going back, you know, people look at Bonnie and Clyde and said this movie set the tone for the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what it was doing, it was trying to harken back. You know, when we look at stuff like Star Wars, and it's like people look at Star Wars and they take stuff from Star Wars, and that kind of became the modern movie, like well into the 90s. What Lucas was doing in a lot of ways was harkening back to old serials and to old Japanese movies.
And
it's interesting to think that the movies that set the tone are themselves trying to recapture something of the past.
And I think that's an important kind of distinction to make, is if you look at only the surface of this, it could conceivably be a gangster picture with, I don't know, Mickey Rooney and Betty Ross. Who's Betty Ross? I don't know. Betty Davis, Ross. Betty Ross married the Hulk. But if you actually pay attention to what's going on, and it's weirdly subversive in this, that's where you really see the parts that, you know, kind of depressed me and reminded me of, you know, the Ford and Carter eras of America, where everything had that weird dark underbelly to it. But as you go through the film, a lot of it is played absolutely straightforward. A lot of it is kind of like, yeah, here's this gangster moment. And then afterwards, we get this little shot of Clyde looking incredibly nervous, like he can't believe he's still alive. Or Bonnie being like, oh my God, I can't believe that I thought this guy was cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and having that momentary doubt. You
know? Zach, what did you pick up from the story elements that you would want to incorporate or use in the future?
Really, like, from the story, the biggest thing was the ending, where CW's dad tells him essentially something's going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's letting the audience know something big is about ready to happen, and they're probably not going to get out of it this time because, I mean, we're getting close to the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole time when Bonnie and Clyde are kind of having this nice afternoon in the town, and they're going to stop at this to help their old farmer man fix his tire, it's like, you know, something is, because my heart was just beating so fast because, like, I didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but something bad was going to happen.
Right.
And so you can, to give the audience more information than the characters, can greatly build a sense of apprehension for what's about to happen next, and it can heighten the emotions for the next scene.
Excellent.
And let's give us some shout outs to our associate producers for Zach on Film this week. They are Richard Pulfer, Royce McWee III, Nellie Perry, Russell Kett, Robert Graham Gemmel, Tony Bishop, Cody Dixon, Brian Gantley, Tan Jing Min, Alan Bruce, Joseph Calarudo, Jason Berry, Ivan Peterson, Daniel Jusen, and Michelle Nielsen. Thank you for supporting Major Spoilers and letting us do so many shows every week, and it's all because of you.
So what did you think about, like, the editing, the story pacing, the kind of flip-flopping almost between comedy and intense action? What did you think of all of that?
Well, flipping between comedy and tragedy and, like, death and action and everything is an interesting concept, because generally that's how life plays out, is these either subtle sways of huge emotions or very drastic changes of emotion really quick, depending on, you know, how you react to certain things. So I feel like if you can do that right, it certainly can feel more lifelike. And this is a story that takes place over a long period of time.
Right.
So you would expect to see jumps of emotion. And they can't, I mean, they can't show you every scene and every bank robbery they did in this film. So, jumping between kind of styles or emotions, it didn't really bother me. I did. The only thing that kind of bothered me, which I kind of loved, was, like, big emotional gunfight and then banjo picking escape music, which I think is probably the greatest car chase music.
It's like the Foggy Mountain Breakdown or whatever it is. Yeah, Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah.
And that Latin should be placed over every car chase scene in any movie.
My friend Charlie learned to play the banjo just so he could play Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
It's a good goal in life.
It is a good goal in life.
But is this movie, were there banjo cover chase scenes before this movie?
Probably.
Because I was looking at it and I was like, oh, haha, banjo music. And then I was like, okay, wait, they're in, like, northern Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas.
Right.
The characters are from that area.
Mm-hmm.
All the story takes place in that area. It makes sense for there to be banjo music playing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, especially bluegrass music, especially.
Yeah, yeah. As like, was, you know, and there's lots of car chases, and this is like, is Bonnie and Clyde the one that set that as the universal chase music?
Yes, this was the first time. This is the first time Foggy Mountain Breakdown had been used as a chase song, and it did set that precedent for future chase scenes to use that same kind of oldie timey banjo-y or flat out using this song as their chase music.
Yeah, another great example of something that the filmmaker says, well, this is an upbeat song to have for this chase. And it makes sense like within the context of what we're looking at. And then people afterward, 1,000 times, just kind of either removing that or referencing it comedically, mm-hmm. and it becoming completely separated from the source material. Mm-hmm.
So what's really interesting, though, is originally, now Arthur Penn was the director of this movie. Originally, they wanted Francois Truffaut to do the film, but he was too busy with Fahrenheit 451. Then they wanted Jean-Luc Godard to do it next, but he didn't trust Hollywood, so he refused to do it. So eventually it came down to Arthur Penn. Now, what's interesting about Godard and Truffaut is that they're part of the French New Wave movement of film, which heavily, heavily, heavily influenced a lot of the directors that you're influenced by, or maybe we're all influenced by. I mean, Coppola, Lucas, Spielberg, De Niro, and others all point to the French New Wave as these films that they were seeing when they were kids that came out in the 1950s and really early 60s that really changed the way of thinking, because they were art films that were not your traditional John Ford Western wide expanse stuff. And they often use jump cuts, choppy editing sequences, basically everything that we see in this film mm-hmm. to tell their story. And if you've ever seen the movie Breathless, and it's worth checking out Breathless. I don't think it's not on this list. Breathless is an interesting. No. This is Truffaut's. I think it's Truffaut, or maybe it's Godard.
Original.
Yeah.
I believe it is Truffaut.
And it is so trippy in how it's telling the story about a shyster and this girl that he's fallen in love with. Not a lawyer, I shouldn't say shyster. This con artist. And this girl that he falls in love with and their exploits, a little bit Bonnie and Clyde-ish mm-hmm. In his portrayal. But it's so interesting that Penn then, knowing who these directors are, really embraces that style of filmmaking and kind of brings this French New Wave style to America and incorporates it in American films. You may not like Breathless because it does kind of extend out and have some really weird moments that don't seem like they would normally belong in a film. But it might be worth checking out. And it came out, I think I want to say 51. I want to say is when Breathless came out.
1960 is what.
Oh, what is it? 1960? Okay. So
yeah,
there's another one that's very close to following that French New Wave movement, but not all the way. And that's a movie called Amelie. Have you ever seen Amelie? It's a French film. Really, really good. Kind of has a lot of the same similar tones and editing style and kind of craziness. But it's interesting that here are the French influencing American films, which then influence, you know, these directors who then influence a whole new generation of people like J.J. Abrams and others to create films. So if you're not familiar with French New Wave, you might want to check that out
totally.
And learn a little bit more about that, because the editing is where this style really shines, because it can be so choppy and you can get rid of it. I mean, you see this in Easy Rider as well, in that style, just kind of very chaotic, mm-hmm. Very loose. And then, of course, the final death scene where they're getting blown away, shot in slow motion, some of it shot fast, but just these really cut, really
super fast
edits.
Cuts.
And I forget, I remember seeing a documentary years ago where the editor was talking about how she and this other editor were editing this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it just took a long time to try to just get it right. And they were like slicing frame frame off until they got it just exactly the way it worked out. And they said it was a long time just editing that final, what is it, a minute and a half of the movie.
Yeah, I mean,
58 seconds.
Once Clyde realizes what's happening, it's just rapid fire cuts.
Yeah, yeah.
All and, the way up.
But also notice that it's not only just rapid cuts, but it's also we're shooting this from multiple angles. We've already seen, you know, like Clyde get hit in the head. Mm. Now let's see that scene from another angle of him getting hit in the head again. And now let's see it from another angle of him getting hit in the head. And that's something that editing kind of allows you to do. It kind of allows you to manipulate time in that fashion to where you don't always have to tell a sequence linearly in a straight line. But you can back up and say, well, let's take a look at it from this angle. Let's take a look at it from this angle. Who did the movie Triple X? Who was the director behind that?
With Vin Diesel?
Yes, with Vin Diesel.
The guy that did Fast and the Furious?
Is he the same one that does the
I feel like it is. I could be
Rob,
off.
Rob Cohen.
Okay, so Rob Cohen is influenced by movies like Bonnie and Clyde and also from like extreme skateboard video stuff. So when he approached Triple X, he's looking at these movies and saying, well, wait a minute, we can tell this same stunt from 10 different angles and it's okay to show that same shot again and again and again. So if you see Triple X, it's kind of, I'm not saying it's like Bonnie and Clyde, but you see the influence there where Vin Diesel is on the motorcycle and he's getting ready to jump over the barbed wire fence and the things are exploding all around him. You see that sequence from 10 different angles, all starting over from the moment that the explosion occurs. So the explosion occurs, the jump occurs, you back up. The explosion occurs, the jump occurs from a different angle, and it keeps doing that five or six times in that sequence because that's what you can do with editing, and that's what you can do with this fluid movement of time and editing. It's real fascinating, and it's not something that we think about because normally when we think about editing a jump, there's the takeoff, the midair, and then the landing, and that's all that you show, and you show it in that linear fashion. But as we see with Bonnie and Clyde, and especially in that final sequence, you can do whatever you want.
Sure. And, I mean, we've seen the concept of looping back in time or messing with time in other movies, but it's generally in larger sequences. I mean, like when Memento is backwards, it's like forward and backwards, but it's giant sequences. And I think as you start dropping the time frame that you're going to loop back on, you have to be very conscious of it. And it has to be for certain things because, I mean, manipulating time... can confuse your audience, and if you start doing it rapid fire of you're looping back on the same shot over and over and over again, if it's not done well, then you could confuse your audience, and they might think, oh, this just happened six separate times, and not we're not seeing different angles of the same thing.
Yeah,
but I don't think that happened here.
No, I mean, it's, I don't know, it's a different editing style that I think maybe you should probably watch a few times to really kind of see what they're doing. Cause it's pretty crazy. I mean, it's not like your traditional editing style at all. And I think that's something to watch out for. What else did you pick up from this, from a technical side that you think that you might want to incorporate? What about the rear screen projection? You going to use that?
No.
Why not?
Well, it's not very good.
Why not?
Well, I mean, the technology they had then is not very good. I've seen some great rear projection, and it still gets used today.
I forget. I was just watching a show or a movie just the other day that was like a relatively recent movie.
Tom Cruise's Oblivion, when they're up in their giant space thing, it's like huge rear screen projection.
And that works really well. Yeah. But, I mean, anytime you're looking at car driving.
Car scenes are...
It doesn't work. And we've seen that again and again from It Happened One Night to Citizen Kane to Bonnie and Clyde to
every movie
Seinfeld.
That's done a rear projection and a car scene. Yeah. It does not look good. It doesn't look good. I mean, it, sometimes green screen doesn't look that great.
No.
But generally you can get a better look than rear screen.
Well, and it's because you're trying to accommodate the needs of the film to create this believable world without having to go on location and do it again and again and again, where you can just create a film loop and say, okay, let's back it up. Let's do this again, project it, and let's go. You know, I don't know, in the 60s, who knows what, I don't know what the exposure latitude is, but it would be also very hard to get a proper exposure on the people in the car and the outside without filling that car with so much light that their faces would melt like Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, you know, maybe green screen helps that out a lot.
Oh yeah.
I mean, spoilers.
Oh, sorry. don't look, Rodrigo. Don't look. Whatever you do, don't look.
The crow said, don't look.
Yeah, spoiler.
Mine's a spoiler.
But yeah, I think it's the timing, right? I mean, you're reacting to what's on the screen behind you, and if the car starts to turn and in the rear screen projection, and then you're starting to turn, there is that, you know, half second of where it's crazy delayed, and unless you're actually driving the car, you're missing out on a lot of that stuff. Okay. So it does look silly though.
For me, the most striking thing about the movie
mm-hmm.
came during the wide shot. Bonnie had run away.
Oh, through the field,
that extreme wide mm-hmm. shot of the cornfield, mm-hmm. and you see the light changing as the clouds go across the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to you, I'm sitting there and I'm going, "This is brilliant. This is beautiful. How did they do it?" And then I realized, "Oh yeah, it's 1967. There were clouds going across the sun."
Yeah.
But it's so gorgeous, and it gives that whole scene just this weird alien perspective that you don't have anywhere else in the movie. And then they do that whole sequence with the family reunion, and you have the clouds passing over, and I'm just like, this is beautiful.
Yeah,
this
let's
is like a
completely talk about that. That was a weird scene.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be a dream until she referenced it 2 seconds after that scene was over, because it looked like they shot it on a different camera and then blew it up.
Oh, really?
I mean, I was like,
they actually shot it completely through a grainy.
It is so strange.
They shot it through a screen on purpose to give it a weird sort of alien feel.
Yeah, dreamlike feel. Yeah.
That's what it felt like.
Interestingly, all the family members are just people that bystanders that showed up that day to see what was going on. And Bonnie's mother was actually just a person who was standing around. They're like, how would you like to play the mother in this movie? And she's like, okay.
Wow.
Bonnie, you're going to die. I can't stand how you're acting with your life.
You're gonna bring her back. Don't you live near me, Mr. Clyde Barrow, because I don't want to watch you die horribly in a hail of gunfire like we're all gonna in 12 minutes.
And
over again from different angles.
And I'm gonna catch a stray bullet.
Four different cameras and four different speeds.
Into my eyeball. What about that? Getting shot in the eye.
Oh,
no. No, the scene where Lex Luthor and Roseanne's mom get killed, or in one case killed, I guess, that is just horrifying, terrifying sequence. And again, it's those moments where you're like, oh, it's 1967. I wonder if they're really just shooting at these poor people.
Well, with your love of Warren Beatty, you probably were hoping
it
was. Yeah.
Yeah. We're just going to shoot some folk and we're going to put it on film. And that'll be our big movie.
Why are Bonnie and Clyde, why do we romanticize these two to the point where their car's on like display at the Smithsonian or something?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's actually in a creepy roadside attraction somewhere in Arizona.
Oh, is that where it is now? I thought at one point it was at the Smithsonian.
I don't know that it's not so much that, I mean, we have inherited that romanticism from the people that did romanticize them. I think, I mean, they were a national phenomenon when they were alive.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you why people romanticize them. It in the 30s, during the Depression, there were a lot of guys who were like outlaws. You had your Dillinger and you had the Ma Barker and Pretty Boy Floyd and all of those characters that would circle around, you know, and you'd hear about, yeah, Doc Barker did this, she, and everybody in the 30s also talked like that for some reason. But if you look at Bonnie and Clyde, Bonnie and Clyde had the three letters, the S-E-X are going for them,
mm-hmm.
because they're not just a you know, a desperado. It's a desperado couple. It's a pretty young couple in their 20s. They were both like 24 when they were shot. I mean, these are very, very young people, and they have that literal romantic vibe to them. I mean, they are a couple and they run a gang, and it's like, this is what the new young kid thing is going to do. And in the 50s, then they'll all drive off a cliff with Natalie Wood. But I think Bonnie and Clyde had that expectation at a time when the world was extremely limited. And, you know, the population was 80% unemployed. There was no money, no jobs, no, you know, no cash, no whatever. That's a 10 years after joke, and I'm not going to do it well. It was a time where they ignored the rules. rules where they ignored all the mores. They went out, they became criminals because that's, you know, that was how you fought the system. But it was like a Robin Hood couple. It was like Romeo and Juliet Robin Hood is what it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That vigilante aspect certainly leads bit to it.
Yeah, and I think they try to kind of reiterate that by saying, well, you know, one of the first robberies, he's like, is that your money, old man, or is that the bank's? Well, that's my money. Well, you keep your money. We're only robbing from the banks.
You keep your money. We're robbing the bank, yep. And that moment where Gene Hackman literally just scales up and goes right over the top of the teller's cage.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just amazing. And I looked at that and I was like, wow, I wonder if anybody ever really did that. But God, that's brilliant to look at.
So here's what the Wikipedia has on their deaths. Approximately 9:15 on May 23rd, the posse concealed in the bushes, and this is the posse headed by the Texas Ranger.
Uncle Jesse.
Heard Barrow's stolen Ford V8 approaching at high speed. The posse's official report had Barrow stopping to speak with Melvin's father, CW's father in the film, who had been planted there with his truck that morning to distract Barrow and force him into the lane closer to the posse. The lawman opened fire, killing Barrow and Parker while shooting a combined total of 130 rounds. Oakley fired first, Prentice Oakley, that's the deputy, killing Barrow in the initial headshot. But Hinton reported hearing Parker scream as she realized Barrow was dead before the shooting at her fully began. The officers emptied all their arms in the car. Any one of the many wounds suffered by Bonnie and Clyde would have been fatal. Any one of the many wounds would have been fatal.
Yeah. Ugh. And this is 1934.
Each of the six officers had a shotgun. Each of the six officers had a shotgun and an automatic rifle and pistols.
Good gracious.
But you look at some of the pictures of the car.
They did not have the Tommy guns that we saw.
No. But you look at some of the shots of the car, and it's like bullets that would have been dead on. This shows you how thick the metal was on these cars. Didn't even penetrate. Just caused big dents in the car. Wow, crazy.
Well, yeah, there's two things going on. Cars built like tanks.
Yeah.
And gun technology. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like somebody gets shot in the eye in this,
mm-hmm.
And nothing happens to her. Yeah, I mean, she might lose the eye, but getting shot in the face doesn't kill her.
And something that this is terrible, and I'm saying this right now, do not do this. Do not do this. When I was younger, I read a book called Hollywood Babylon, which led me to a number of books that had things. And one of the things that they had was Clyde Barrow at the scene in the car.
Mm-hmm.
He clearly took a bullet in the eye.
Repeat.
Do not go looking for that image, people. You don't want
to
see
it. Too late. Zach already did it.
But yeah, I know. Zach's a jerk. And lots of people are. You know, I'm not going to finger wave at anybody who does. But be aware, it is extremely graphic and gruesome if you do go looking for it. I'm sure it's easy to find in the internet. But it's something where, and even if you look at it on the film, that last scene with Faye Dunaway hanging out of the car like a bag of potatoes.
Yep.
I mean, disturbing, just disturbing. And the bit where he turns and Clyde is starting to run for the car. And as the bullets rain down, you see, and it's a brilliant effect. You see a piece of his skull fly off.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they did it. I'm sure it was just some guy.
Oh, it's all squibs. It's all squibs. Yeah. I just find it. So did you like the movie, Rodrigo? Ugh.
Yeah. It's probably not something that I'll specifically seek out very often, but I did enjoy it. It had, you know, movies from this era are very episodic. So it's like the moment that the movie started, I kind of knew where it was going to end, but you don't know what's going to happen in the middle, right? The thing about these movies is that the whole point is the journey. It's kind of like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, right? There's lots of stuff that happened in the middle, and sometimes you think to yourself, is that actually the same movie? Like, what does that have to do with anything? And once you get over a lot of our modern sensibilities about movies where, like, every last thing has to be directly related to the plot or character development or something like that, these movies weren't that tight about that and didn't want to be. So, you know, it's a cute little movie about gangsters up until everyone dies. And that's actually, you know, pretty, basically what I was hoping for as soon as the movie started.
So Zach, what are you taking away from this?
I still think that the tension building thing was really big for me,
mm-hmm.
Letting the audience know more than the characters do. That you can use interesting shot angles. I mean, they threw some POV shots in here, which were interesting to look at when they're robbing the banks, and you kind of go into Clyde's perspective. It was just an interesting angle. I wish that we still had car runners so I could jump on the side of someone's car. Thought that a lot during this movie.
And now today you have to buy them
went much slower then.
As an add-on.
Yeah.
Those high-speed car chases were 45 miles an hour.
Yeah.
That's how fast those cars go.
Anything else?
No, those are the two big things. And I have to go back and watch more of the editing to compare that to...
Yeah, and take a look at the French New Wave. Take a look at the French New Wave and just read up on it and so you're familiar with it, because I'm sure at some point someone will say, so Zach, what do you think of French New Wave?
I'd be like, I have no idea.
Well, you don't want to be that guy.
Oh, c'est bon.
I will say that as the guy who plays a lifelong, endless game of Hey, It's That Guy, this is the most distracting movie for playing Hey, It's That Guy that we've ever had on Zach on Film, because everybody is somebody else. Gene Hackman, the actress who played Roseanne's mom, the main lawbreaker character is Denver Pyle, that we know from Andy Griffith's show and The Dukes of Hazzard. Even, you know, minor characters like CW's dad is Dub Taylor.
Yeah.
Dub Taylor is one of those characters who's in everything.
Apple Dumpling
the
Gang.
The second that the character shows up played by Gene Wilder, I'm just like, oh my God, Gene Wilder's amazing. And I started thinking about everything else that Gene Wilder has been in. But in my minor research, I did discover that the Undertaker character getting kidnapped by Bonnie and Clyde actually did happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And supposedly that character was brought in to identify the bodies, and apparently was one of the Undertakers who worked on the bodies once they were deceased.
Interesting.
Once they had been shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that is at least not entirely factual, but factually derived.
Excellent. Cool. Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, Rodrigo.
Yeah, and that's going to do it all for this week on Zach on Film. Make sure you head over to majorspoilers.com to find this podcast posting page and give your thoughts on Bonnie and Clyde or anything we discussed in this episode. While you are there, click on Amazon.com, where you can do all of your shopping needs. Buy Bonnie and Clyde on Blu-ray or a new Blu-ray player or TV. Nothing's going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to us to keep us doing shows week after week.
Where's
after
that again?
Week for you.
Where's
that's
that again?
That's at majorspoilers.com.
And you click on what?
The Amazon.com link.
Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yes. So that's it for this week. Next week, we will be talking 2001... A Space Odyssey.
Get your LSD ready, Zach.
I know what
you ready to get. You ready to get high?
I'm. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna be tripping like a monkey.
All right.